One of the alleged victims of former Penn State coach Jerry Sandusky has hired a lawyer to start a civil suit against the school. Sandusky, charged with 21 felony counts of abuse of young boys over a 15-year period, two Penn State officials charged with covering it up. Some legal scholars say suing the school could be tricky. State institutions are often protected by a doctrine known as sovereign immunity. Now, assistant coach Mike McQueary isn't charged for witnessing what he said was the rape of a child back in 2002 and not stopping it or calling the police because he did what he was required to do by state law. He told his boss, Coach Joe Paterno, who told his boss's school officials. Today, Pennsylvania lawmakers are moving to change the existing law and require anyone who works with kids to report suspected abuse directly to the police. But what's legal is small comfort to a lot of people. The question all weekend has been, why would you need a law to tell you to stop the rape of a child or report it to the police? Listen to this exchange between the columnist David Brooks and E.J. Dionne on Meet the Press. Brooks starts, and he says the problem is an anything-goes moral decline.
If you're alert to the sense of what evil is, you have a script to follow. And this is necessary because people do not intervene. There's been a ton of research on this. They ask people, if you saw something cruel, if you saw racism and sexism, would you intervene? Then they hire actors and they put it right in front of them. People do not intervene. It's called the bystander effect. Mm-hmm. It happens again and again. And that's why we need these scripts to remind people how evil can be all around.
I think David is way too abstract here. You know that what was happening in that shower, as alleged in the indictment, was wrong. And yes, people may be uncertain about what to do. They may worry about their standing and their job. But God, you hope that if you had been standing there, and I think most people feel this way, you would have gone in and you would have tried to stop that.
Isn't that what everyone is saying? That you would hope that you would stop the rape of a child if you saw it? But what happens to people when they don't? And how is this national conversation about alleged pedophilia affecting people who've been victims of the real thing? That's our conversation today with David Clossy, director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. It's a victims advocacy group. He's an advocate for victims of clergy sex abuse and a victim of that abuse as a child himself. David, welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, we want to say right out, no one knows what Mike McQueary was thinking. We're not asking you that. But rather, what your sense is in your experience of what happens to people when they don't stop these events. First of all, this bystander effect. It was named after bystanders who allegedly stood by while a young girl named Kitty Genovese was murdered in New York. It's been shown that not that many people actually stood by. Some did call the police. But is this what you hear from victims, that there were people who knew what was happening to them and did nothing?
Yes, we hear often that there were folks who clearly knew and did nothing, or had strong reason to suspect and did nothing. And certainly we also see cases where those who witnessed abuse or suspected abuse did the absolute bare minimum, told a colleague or told an immediate supervisor, but refused to call the police and refused to follow up. It happens very, very often, unfortunately.
Well, let's tick off some of the reasons, and in your experience, they do that. I mean, we know, for instance, there was a janitor who also alleges that he saw Jerry Sandusky abusing a child. I think this was in the year 2000. He told his colleagues and his immediate boss. He was absolutely clear. He was sick to his stomach, and people around him said they thought he was going to have a heart attack. So he was taking it in emotionally what he saw, but he was worried about losing his job. So we can hear that. But why else would someone not do something?
Well, it's a terrific question. I think in many cases where the predator is extremely popular and powerful, some people literally can't bring themselves to believe their own eyes. When a horrific act like the rape of a child so dramatically and clearly contradicts a lifetime of positive experiences you may have had with a coach, with a minister, it really is emotionally and psychologically very tough for some people to believe they actually saw what they saw.
Psychologist Stanley Cohen talked to Time magazine about this. He calls it interpretive meaning. You just can't interpret what you're seeing because this person was, you know, had such a position of honor in your life. But then we also hear that there's something that's the opposite of that, that, in 12-step groups, you know, they call it the elephant in the living room syndrome. Everybody's heard about the elephant in the living room. That if you've actually been trained to not see the elephant in the living room, be it abuse or, you know, alcoholism or something on the part of someone that you love or honor, that later as an adult, you can't see it.
We do see that phenomenon happening often, where kids are brought up in dysfunctional homes, physical violence, sexual violence, eating disorders, alcoholism. And when those kids see every other responsible person in their lives ignoring the dysfunction, then that's what kids learn to do, ignore it and minimize it. So, you know, it's possible that some of the people who witnessed Sandusky's crimes or strongly suspected them in Pennsylvania grew up in households in which the norm was essentially to pretend that horrible things weren't in fact happening. And, of course, that makes it much easier as an adult to pretend that horrible things really aren't happening, or at least they don't rise to the level of forcing you to take action.
Or forcing you to go back to those own memories, you know, that you might have buried when you were a child and were seeing the same things. But, you know, we've had some spirited conversations about this in the office, David Klossy. There are people who just can't believe this. They can't believe that you could be so emotionally wrought that you could be, I mean, I've heard people describe it as being literally blinded, like a white light comes up, that you can't see something because it takes you back to that time or because you've been trained not to see it. They just don't believe that.
Sure. Well, you know, unfortunately, I would ask those doubters to think about domestic violence. There are many people who just can't believe that a woman or a man would live day in, day out with someone who periodically beats them up. There are people who can't believe that children repress horrific childhood memories of trauma and sexual abuse. But, you know, the mind is an amazing device, and it has amazing coping skills to get people through a very upsetting situation. I personally, based on 23 years' experience in SNAP, I don't have any difficulty believing that, in fact, there were one or two or three staffers at Penn State who just couldn't accept that what they were seeing by Sandusky was childhood victimization.
It reminds me, I spoke to a doctor once while reporting on a program at Rutgers University. They have an alcohol studies program there. It was under the late Janet Whitehits. He was a pediatrician, and he realized that when children would come in who are obviously having problems because of the alcoholism in the home, he didn't want to see that. He didn't want to be reminded of what happened to him as a child, and so he sedated those children. He realized that as a doctor, he actually went that far to not see it.
It's tragic.
Have you actually heard from people who've said they saw it but couldn't see it?
Yes, absolutely. And one other component about this is that these predators are not dumb individuals. They're very shrewd. They're very cunning. And when our psychological impulses tell us to deny what we've seen, and then you've got a charismatic, popular predator who comes along and says, no, it really wasn't a back rub. I was just putting suntan lotion on the little girl, bingo, then that gives us our out. That reinforces our instinctive denial. So it's a two-part process. Number one, we're blinded by our own emotional baggage. Then we're further blinded when the predator has some explanation that maybe to you and me and to other outsiders seems laughable on its face, but seems plausible to the person who witnessed the abuse.
David Klossy, director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. We're talking about the Penn State scandal, former coach Jerry Sandusky charged with abusing children. NBC interviewed Sandusky in 1987. Let's listen.
I enjoy being around children. I enjoy their enthusiasm. I just have a good time with them.
David Klossy, this underscores, you know, child abusers, alleged child abusers, can be trusted, gregarious figures. But what's happening to you and other victims as you hear this?
Well, it's chilling. It's chilling and it's distressing and ironically encouraging at the same time. It's encouraging because no one is disbelieving these boys. No one is claiming that there's some kind of anti-university or anti-football bias going on. You know, those kinds of denial mechanisms we see oftentimes in church contexts. But it's very distressing because this is a university. These are well-educated men and they're powerful men. So, you know, one could perhaps understand a custodian saying, gosh, if I report this popular coach, I'm the one who'll get in trouble. But nobody really thinks that about Joe Paterno or about the university vice president. These were men who had secure jobs, and if they called 911, nobody thinks they would have been out on the street unemployed. So it's really depressing for many of us who have dealt with clergy sex abuse for so many years and have wanted to believe that our pain and our efforts have made a difference and have deterred decision makers from ignoring and concealing child sex crimes. You know, we do see so very little progress in the church hierarchy, but we comfort ourselves by saying, okay, outside the church, however, schools, summer camps, daycare centers, athletic association, surely these authority figures who run these institutions have gotten the message and have reformed. But when that apparently doesn't happen, it's very distressing to many, many victims of childhood abuse.
Well, it's interesting, David. In the last couple of days, I've had two exchanges, two people come up to me that I know but not well, and they started talking about the coverage of the story and how it was unsettling to them. And then both people separately said to me, well, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I was a victim of sex abuse, and it happened a few decades ago, and that's why this is stirring me up. Are you hearing from people who are having that almost, it's almost like post-traumatic stress, you know, that this story is igniting this in them?
Yes. I think this story, you know, if you really want to think about the silver lining and not the horror of this story, any high-profile sex abuse case does prompt others who have been suffering in silence for years and years to come forward.
And yet, we have to ask you about, for instance, the man who'd been abused as a child by priests who committed suicide after it was revealed in the news media that he'd been abused. We're hearing from the lawyer who's representing the one allegedly abused young boy who's going forward with a case, who says that his client is both angry at the school for what happened to him, but he's devastated because Jerry Sandusky brought him into this football program, and now he's blaming himself for what's happening to Penn State. So there are conflicting emotions here.
Very much so. The overall pattern, I think, for most men and women who are sexually abused as children is to blame themselves somehow, either for the abuse they suffered, for the abuse that other kids have suffered in the years following their victimization. Gosh, if only I had spoken up sooner, I might have stopped some of this. And sometimes we blame ourselves for the damage done to the institution that employed the molester. It's hard for people to really understand this, but predators really do twist the minds of their victims and make their victims feel somehow responsible for the wrongdoing. And so when a scandal like this erupts in public, it can be very cathartic and very healing and very empowering for a lot of victims, but it can also unleash a tremendous amount of emotional turmoil, sometimes even feelings of affection for the predator himself.
Yeah. Well, and we think of that conflict with the story of our own senator here in Massachusetts, Senator Scott Brown, who revealed in his memoirs earlier this year that he'd been molested by a camp counselor when he was young. But he wouldn't identify his alleged abuser. He said, you know, I don't even know if this guy is alive or if he's number two doing it again. He said this on a local radio show, going on to say that this abuser would be about 70. Well, Jerry Sandusky is 67.
Right.
You know, so, right. You know, I'm not being critical of Scott Brown's decision, but it just shows what conflict there is.
Yes, absolutely. But I would urge every listener to disabuse themselves of this convenient but completely wrong-headed notion that somehow the mere passage of time magically cures child molesters. It really, really doesn't. And in fact, some have argued that as molesters get older and they look less threatening, they're in fact more able to get access to kids and hurt kids, right? When you look at a 70-year-old man who's got thick glasses and thin hair and walks slowly, the last thing in the world that crosses your mind is he could be a criminal. It's dead wrong to think that somehow, just with the passage of time, a child molester magically becomes safer.
And David, let's just close where we began. The idea of, you know, why people don't report it when they see it. Is there something as a country we need to deal with? I mean, we're hearing that in Sweden, they passed a law outlawing hitting a child, and Swedes walk up to people on the street and stop parents from hitting their children. In this country, there seems to be more of a, you know, the rights of the individual and the family, an unwillingness to interfere in other people's business. Is there some kind of shift that has to happen in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. I think you're right. There's a preoccupation in this country with minding our own business and especially not interfering in what's considered a family dispute or a family difficulty. And in some countries, Sweden especially, there's in fact a very different notion, which is that children come first, and all of us have a duty to protect children. So we do need legislative reform. We need to repeal and reform the statutes of limitations. We need to beef up these mandatory reporting laws. But beyond that, we really do need a cultural change which gives people the permission to overcome their initial fears and pick up the phone and call 911 or intervene when we suspect or see abuse happening, so that this kind of horror just doesn't continue forever and ever.
Or maybe, as you said, get some help for yourself if you found you couldn't. There may be
right.
something else going on there. David Classy, he's director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, a victim's advocate for victims of clergy sex abuse, and also a victim of that abuse when he was a child. David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.